Space Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about some new films, including Renfield, The Pope's Exorcist, Murder Mystery 2, Schmigadoon Season 2, and Time Bandits. I'm also going to be talking about the news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Blue Thermal. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
I'm just going to quickly breeze through the box office because it was a massive release for Super Mario Brothers movie. It made almost $150 million over the weekend. That's not even including Wednesday and Thursday opening as well. By the end of the weekend, it had amassed over $200 million, which is a massive haul for an animated film. It was a wild success. And I mean, if you recall my review, I thought it was a fine movie. I didn't think it was great. I thought it was a kid's movie. It's a cartoon. But I think it certainly plays to the fact there's nothing really aimed at family audiences. I mean, everyone says, oh, Shazam Fury of the God. Nobody cares about Shazam Fury of the God. You can shut up now, Zachary Levi. You know, stop making posts on the internet. But there really isn't anything for kids, and it was during spring break. So, yeah, Super Mario Brothers did really well. Going into the weekend this week, it's got $250 million in its coffer. It's got close to $500 million worldwide. So it's a bona fide massive hit. On the flip side, Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves dropped over 60%. To only about $14 million, it's enough for $61 million. It's more than Shazam Fury of the Gods has made in its time. But hopefully for that movie, it shows that it's going to have a little more legs. But let's move on to something else. This past weekend, they had Star Wars Celebration in London. They made a ton of announcements. The things I think got everyone most excited are the new movies that they announced. James Mangold's going to be directing one about the beginning of the Jedi. Dave Filoni, who works on The Mandalorian, is going to be doing one set during the New Republic. People are wondering if it's going to have any sort of cross-pollination with The Mandalorian and those characters. And then one of the people who worked on the Ms. Marvel series, Charmaine Nabob-Chinoy, will direct 15-year past Rise of Skywalker, and she's bringing back Daisy Ridley, which I think is great. I know there's a lot of people that are upset that that's going to be canon now, but it's always going to be canon. To think that Disney's going to come in and say, hey, we're going to just wipe out these movies we spent hundreds of millions of dollars on and mess up the continuity. If they didn't abandon Jar Jar Binks and the droids from the original prequels, they're not going to abandon Rise of Skywalker. So you can dial back your fanboy hate for that. Now, this is not the first time they've announced other movies that are going to be directed by big-time directors. I mean, apparently Patty Jenkins' movie, that's probably still somewhere in development, although not actively. Taika Waititi's supposed to be doing a movie. Rian Johnson was supposed to be doing a trilogy, and I think that's kind of been shelved, at least for now. But they have a whole bunch of like TV series. They're expanding more into the television shows, mainly because it allows them to pump out content throughout the year and not put all their eggs in one basket for a giant movie that could flop or just underperform like what happened with Solo. So I'm looking forward to these new Star Wars movies. Now, in terms of other announcements that were made, on Wednesday, you had Warner Brothers Discovery coming out and saying, hey, this is what's going to happen with our streaming services, because they've got Discovery Plus that has all the reality television stuff, and they got HBO Max, and they're dropping the HBO, and I think they're doing that because they don't want it to be something that's completely pulled by HBO, because HBO has a very specific content base, which is incredible content. They've had great award-winning dramas for decades. But I think they want to diversify the name, so they just chose Max, which I don't know if that's a great name. It's not, but they're doing the same thing where they're leaning into some of the programs. They've dropped a teaser for Penguin, which is a spinoff of The Batman. They got a bunch of other dramas that they're bringing back, and they officially announced that Harry Potter redo, which I still think is a dumb idea. Go back to my previous episode. You want to listen to that online and find out why. But they're going to be doing a spinoff of The Big Bang Theory, and they're doing another Game of Thrones prequel and a Conjuring series, and then they're rolling in all of these reality programs under Max. I think they think, oh, we're going to get all the subscribers for both. I think they're going to end up diluting their base. And I think this is going to be overall a bad move. I don't think this is going to rake in the profits or streamline the productions as much as they think it's going to. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about was dropped at Star Wars Celebration, and this is the trailer for Ahsoka, which is coming to Disney Plus in August.
It's been a while. Things have changed. I started hearing whispers about Thrawn's return as heir to the Empire. Prepare for the worst.
I actually really like these Star Wars series. I don't think everything needs to be this big, massive movie. One of the things that I have a problem with when they do these epic $200 million movies is they try to be the beginning and the end of the series. And you don't need it to be. You don't need to blow up planets and wipe out entire fleets of people to make an interesting and compelling story. You can have smaller stories, and I think that's okay. And then, yeah, save it for the big stuff. And that's one of the things Marvel's done very well. You have big movies, but you have somewhat self-contained movies. And I think that's what kept Marvel going for so long. And then you have the Infinity War, and then you have that's the one that crosses everything. So Ahsoka seems to be a little more specific and laying seeds for other things. They're building a universe here, or they're expanding it, rather. They're not building it. They're building onto it. And I like the flavor of the different series. And not every single one needs to be the same. I like the fact that this is dipping into The Mandalorian and Boba Fett, because that's where the character of Ahsoka first showed up as a live-action version. But they're also tying back to the original Clone Wars stories from the animated series, and they're bringing back Thrawn as a villain, and he goes all the way back to Timothy Zahn's books when there was like no other real extended universe stuff. Those were the first tie-in books outside of like the Brian Daley and Orson Scott Card stories that came out in the 70s and 80s. So I'm looking forward to that. I think this one's going to be a lot of fun. Now, the next one I want to talk about is The Marvels, which is coming to theaters on November 10th.
Hi.
We're looking for Kamala Khan.
Period.
Okay, so our powers are entangled.
I can manipulate light energy. And you,
I could totally show you.
No!
Not again!
Hi.
Where's our daughter?
Wherever you were.
We're a team.
Oh, no, we're not a team.
We're not a team.
I was not a huge fan of Captain Marvel, the movie. I mean, not that I had a problem with it. It wasn't at the level of a massive Avengers movie. It surprised me it did as well as it did, but I still thought it was an enjoyably fun movie. I really liked Ms. Marvel. I thought that was a great little series, and the character of Kamala Khan is, she's just adorable. I mean, she really is fun because she is so caught up in the wonder of everything, and she's what makes this trailer work. I mean, Brie Larson kind of takes herself a little too seriously, which is kind of the character, and balancing her with somebody like Kamala Khan is brilliant, and she's great in the trailer. I'm really looking forward to this because, like I said, it's a big cosmic movie, and it's drawing from the TV series. I know people are going, oh, I have to watch TV series to understand the movie. No, you don't. They're going to explain everybody's backstory. It's not that complicated. Oh, hey, here's a fighter pilot from the 90s who got superpowers. Oh, hey, here's a teenage girl from New York who got superpowers. Oh, hey, here's a woman who works for the government who got superpowers. Oh, we're all up to speed? Good. Here we go. That's all you need to do. So, yeah, quit bellyaching that I have to watch TV to watch a movie. No, you don't. This looks like it's going to be relatively self-contained, telling its own story. Yeah, it's going to tie into other stuff. But this one looks fun. I am very much looking forward to it. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about The Pope's Exorcist and Murder Mystery 2. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about the new one this week, or one of the new ones, and that is The Pope's Exorcist. A priest is chosen to perform an exorcism on a boy living in an abandoned Spanish abbey and holds a secret about the church.
There's a case that needs your attention.
Bring me the priest.
I'm here to help, Julia.
Wrong priest!
Take caution. There are secrets buried there.
He's about to conceal.
The church has fought against this demon before. The Vatican covered it up.
I love a good exorcism movie. I've always been a sucker for those. You know, I've always said that there are certain genres that I just kind of like. I'll watch any movie that's from it. And one of my favorite genres, I've said this multiple times before, is the people in the science lab trying to do something good for the world and having to go horribly awry. I love those movies. I don't know why, but I love those movies. And I love a good exorcism movies. The problem is, there aren't a lot of good exorcism movies out there. Oh yeah, The Exorcist is great. The Last Exorcism is actually a pretty good movie. I mean, it's found footage, but it came at the beginning of that trend, so it wasn't too annoying. But I've seen some decent exorcism movies, and I've seen some that are, like, not great, but okay, and there are some that are, like, arguably similar to exorcism movies, like The Manitou, which is not about a Catholic exorcism. But I do find it funny that Hollywood can be very secular until you involve possession, and then everybody finds Jesus. And it's always in the Catholic Church, too. So I appreciate a good exorcism movie. This is not one. I'm not going to bury the lead anymore. This is a terrible movie, and it's terrible to its core. Russell Crowe plays the exorcist, and actually, I like him. I think his performance is good. He's just not given much to work with. First of all, most of the movie takes place in this dumpy little rundown abbey that they're going to be renovating. And they do this thing with the cinematography, and I've run into this with a lot of movies, where it's just so dark. They don't put any lights on the freaking actors. There's literally scenes where people are in shadow. You can't see what their facial expressions are. Now, maybe part of this was the theater I saw it in. Probably didn't have a good bulb in their projector, and that's one of the problems. Everybody talks about, oh, the cinematic experience, and, oh, everybody needs to see it in a theater. Well, not if they're running it at too low of a brightness. And I've seen multiple movies like this, and then you add to it the fact that they use this naturalistic lighting because it looks better and real when it really looks like you're looking through a murky fish tank. I could not see anything in this movie. And part of it's the projection, but part of it's the cinematography. I mean, there's things where every part of their body's lit that's not facing the camera. You can't see things. There's scenes where they're like, there's a scene where this guy like moves something and he looks in a crevice in this wall. And I'm like, I don't even know what he's looking at. I can't resolve it. And that makes it, it's very hard to watch. It's a murky, dingy, bad movie that way. So it looks terrible. The story's convoluted. It's supposedly based on a true story. I don't know. I didn't even look it up. That's how much I didn't care about this movie. It feels like this movie was made by an AI program that just was forced to watch hundreds of hours of exorcism movies and then spat out a script. Because it has all these elements to it that you've seen in other better movies. But they're just going to kind of crammed in there. And this family who's got this kid, they're like Americans, and they've come over to Spain to take care of this abbey because it's the only thing that the dad who died owned, and they want to, you know, make some money on it so that they can actually have some sort of a nest egg. And I mean, seriously, from the minute the family show, I just hated them. I'm like, you know what? The demon's going to have them. They are annoying characters. Bratty, entitled, antagonistic, not a good family. And I get it, they're dealing with the death of their father, but that doesn't mean you can be an a-hole. And that's also, why would you write a story with such unlikable characters that you're supposed to root for? I didn't care about them. I kept falling asleep in the movie, partly because it was like completely dark in the theater and there was nothing going on screen except a murky mess. And I'm trying to follow it. I'm just like, I can't even, it doesn't make any sense. This is a noisy, murky, nonsensical derivative horror movie wannabe. It is terrible. And it's a kind of genre I normally love. So I'm going to have to say Pope's Exorcist totally sucked.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Murder Mystery 2. This is on Netflix. It actually came out last week. this is an Adam Sandler movie, so of course everybody's going to be triggered about it. The Spitzes attend the wedding of a wealthy friend and get caught up in another international murder investigation.
I mean, do you remember what happened last time we went on a getaway?
Yeah, some people died.
Not a lot of people.
You'd think five people dying's a lot.
The Maharaj has been kidnapped.
What?
And all of you are suspects.
We're not going to be invited anywhere ever again.
You must be the Spitzes.
Yes.
Your reputations precede you.
There you go.
Not in a positive way.
Okay.
Okay.
Deliver $50 million to the Arc de Triomphe in Paris when the Maharaja dies.
Well, he always wanted to go to Paris.
It stars Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston. It's a sequel to Murder Mystery, which came out a couple years ago on Netflix. And here's the thing. I've really come around to Adam Sandler. Back when he started making movies, I mean, I'm talking like Happy Gilmore, Billy Madison days, I thought they were very funny. They were juvenile and stupid, but I was also juvenile and stupid. I still am. And then he got to be really a big name, and it kind of peaked with Big Daddy. And then kind of from that point forward, he was trying to do two things. He was trying to do overly dramatic stuff, and he's a good actor, but I never liked his overly dramatic stuff. You know, stuff like Rain Over Me, and I mean, even stuff like Punch Drunk Love was okay, but while he was doing that, then he was just doing the bottom of the barrel, sub-basement garbage college movies. And that's when you ended up with stuff like Grown Ups and Jack and Jill and That's My Boy, and they were awful. And that's when I just started to hate Adam Sandler. As a person, I hear he's like the nicest guy on the planet. As an artist, as a performer. Well, then he got basically this contract with Netflix to do a whole bunch of movies. And I started watching some of them, and they're not great. But you know what? I don't think he has anything to prove with these Netflix movies. He's just like, I'm going to do a stupid movie. And with the murder mystery movies, he's like, I'm going to do a dumb kind of mystery movie. And I'm going to bring my friends along to a nice vacation in Paris where they got to do a little bit of work, but then they can go have fun. And first of all, I want to become friends with Adam Sandler so I can be in one of these movies. But like when he started doing the Netflix films, he wasn't trying to prove himself. He wasn't trying to go over the top. He was just saying, you know what, I'm just going to make a silly little movie. And yeah, he does stuff like Hustle that's trying to get an award as well. But, you know, I feel this the same way with Murder Mystery. I, as much as I'd love to see a crossover between Benoit Blanc and the Spitzes, I don't think we're ever going to get that at Netflix. But It's just a silly, stupid movie. It's a screwball comedy. But aside from the production value of the locations, it's really self-contained. And it's a relatively simple story. It feels like a Columbo episode that's been given an international location and a big budget kind of thing. And you can tell that Adam Sandler's just like, hey, I'm just going to play this average guy. I'm not going to do a silly voice. I'm not going to be obnoxious. I'm not going to play like Jack and Jill where he plays his own sister or anything like that. It's not a shticky movie. It's just these two characters. And it looks like, you know, I'm normally not a big fan of Jennifer Aniston, but she looks like she's having a good time doing these. And I'm like, you know what? These are nice little disposable movies. I mean, yeah, it's not brilliant, but like other recent Adam Sandler comedies, it's just trying to entertain and it really manages to do so. So I'm going to say that Murder Mystery 2 kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, we're going to be talking about Renfield and Schmigadoon Season 2. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Renfield. Dracula's assistant joins a self-help group in an effort to release himself from his master.
My boss, he's different.
You can't get him out of your head.
No.
Renfield, bring me innocent victims.
Some call me the Dark One, others the Lord of Death. To most, I am Dracula.
Okay, obviously we're dealing with a little bit more than just narcissism here.
I remember when this trailer dropped, people lost their minds over it. They thought it looked so funny and it was going to be so much fun. And oh, isn't it great to see Nicolas Cage back? Because if you don't know what happened with Nicolas Cage, he got into some bad business. I mean, in terms of like financial business, he had a couple divorces he had to deal with, and he had to liquidate a bunch of stuff, and he had to pay it all off. So he did a whole bunch of really crappy direct-to-video movies just to crank them out, and I think also to reduce his yearly income. And now he's outside of that window, so he can do bigger movies now. And I think it's great that he's coming back for this. I mean, he had stuff like Mandy, and then he had Pig, and then he had The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent or whatever that was. And but he did some other stuff. And then among all the crap, you know, just the real bargain basement stuff, there is some that are not bad. You know, Willy's Wonderland, Wally's Wonderland, Wally World, I don't forget what it was. And then there's a one where he and Selma Blair played parents who attack their kids. There's some interesting weird stuff that he did, but now he's kind of back doing mainstream film. Well, and I don't know if this would be mainstream. I mean, Renfield is not exactly mainstream. It's a horror action comedy. Let me just put it out there. He's the best thing in the movie. I mean, really, he is so much fun in this film. He completely goes full Cage. He chews through the scenery as he chews through all of his co-stars. He's over the top and crazy, and you get exactly what you expect if you say, hey, we're casting Nicolas Cage as Dracula. And it's silly and it's ridiculous, but not to be outdone is Nicholas Hoult in this movie. Now, Nicholas Hoult, people will recognize him from stuff like he was on The Great on Hulu. He was in the X-Men movies. He played the young version of Beast. He was originally in that show Skins on the BBC. I mean, he's been in a bunch of stuff. And he was in this movie called Warm Bodies about 10 years ago or so, where he played a zombie. That was another sort of horror comedy. He plays Renfield, and he actually brings a real level of humanity to it, because he's stuck as Dracula's familiar, and the only way he can get any sort of power is he has to eat bugs. But you know what? I mean, he carries the movie. He makes you actually care about the characters. Now, there's some pacing issues, and there's some weird chronology where, like, they're in one scene, and then, like, it seems like it's a week later, and the people are back in the same scene, and they're wearing the same clothes. And so I think that there's some filmmaking elements that didn't quite gel with this one. But it's funny. I mean, it has these incredible action sequences that are, you know, over-the-top action where Renfield's killing all the bad guys, and he's, like, ripping limbs off and stabbing people with arms and, you know, just doing insane stuff. And then at the end of the scene, it's like you're at the aftermath of a Gallagher stand-up show. I mean, there's just debris and splatters everywhere. So, I mean, it's over the top and funny that way, and I enjoyed that. I think both Nicholases do a good job, and they balance each other out by playing very polar opposite characters. There is a level of acting nuance in this movie that I think is going undetected by a lot of people because it is just a silly film. It's the kind of movie that I would have seen like in high school and college at one of these late night movie marathons that I would go to, where it never really hit the mainstream theater, but it would have just killed at one of these late night movie marathons. And it's funny. It's not perfect. I mean, Awkwafina's in it as sort of the love interest. And she actually does a good job. I like when she is a vulnerable, regular character and she's not just this wisecracker. I think she actually has some acting chops, and I like to see her develop them more. It's just nobody's brave enough to put her in the love interest part because she's not your typical love interest. But she works in this one, and she has some good chemistry with Nicholas Hoult. So yeah, I think she's good in it, but I mean, it's not a brilliant comedy. It's not a brilliant action film. It's not a brilliant romance. It's not even a brilliant horror film. But you know, it works. And that's what I want out of a movie. It's absurd and silly, but this bloody action flick has some fun performances and some real memorable moments. I had a blast. I really enjoyed Renfield. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Schmigadoon Season 2. Also known as Schmicago. In an effort to regain some happiness in their lives, a couple tries to return to Schmigadoon, but finds themselves in the dark, gritty musicals of the 1970s.
Welcome to Schmicago.
This is very different.
Now our heroes enter the city of Schmicago.
Who is he talking to?
At one point, a lot of musicals had narrators. Sorry, go ahead.
Really? Do I have your permission?
We're in the next era of musicals here.
Do we shock you?
These musicals are darker, with more sex.
Oh, yay.
And violence.
I have somewhat up and down history with movie musicals and show tunes. I've seen quite a few musicals, both as movies and as live performances. My kids were in musical theater in high school, so I saw a whole bunch of stuff there. I've gone to see Broadway level plays. I mean, I've never gone to see a play on Broadway, but you know, when they come to on the tour, I've gone and seen Phantom. I've seen Mamma Mia, you know, and I've seen my handful of big musical numbers, and I've also seen a lot of the movies. And I don't love musicals, but I have seen enough of them that I can appreciate them. And I loved how they framed Schmigadoon in the first season, where you have this couple that ends up in this sort of this Brigadoon version of all the different musicals crammed together. And I mean, I wasn't a big fan of the musical numbers in that series, but you kind of have to have them because that's what it's about. But Schmigadoon season two, they went to a different era where Schmigadoon, the first season, was all these Rodger and Hammerstein musicals, you know, Showboat, Carousel, Brigadoon, Oklahoma, all those kind of classic, you know, feel good kind of 50s musicals. And then they decide to go to the darker era. And so you've got stuff like Chicago and Sweeney Todd and Cabaret. And then you also have the more the hippie musicals, stuff like Godspell and Pippin. And they play off of all of these. And I like that because it's something very different. It is a stark contrast to what goes on in Schmigadoon. It is a very different story, even though they bring the same actors back to play different roles. And they have some new ones, like they got Titus Burgess playing the narrator, because they've got the narrator who shows up in a bunch of stuff, everything from, you know, Pippin to School of Rock. And you know, they nail some of the music. They nail the flavor of Chicago and Cabaret. And they have a whole subplot here with this Sweeney Todd type character. And it gets really dark. At one point, it threatens to get horribly dark, which I loved. And then they back off a little bit, because if it really went down that path, it would have been horrible. But, you know, about halfway through the season, it has the potential to become very, very dark. And there's some parts I don't like. I'm not a big fan of Jane Krakowski. She plays the flashy lawyer, which is a playoff of Chicago. And I just am not a fan of her. I feel like she's looking down her nose at everybody in every part she does. She just feels like she's just snooty in everything she sees. I'm not a big fan of her. So those scenes weren't good. But I also thought they managed to merge and contrast the musicals of the 70s between those hippie musicals like Godspell and real dark stuff like Sweeney Todd or Cabaret. And I mean, it's good. It's well made. It has some funny moments. It doesn't overstay its welcome. It's like 6 episodes. They got about 3 out right now because it actually dropped last week, and it plays into May on Apple TV Plus. But hey, this self-aware musical sitcom has fun with conventions and plays to the darker side of the genre for some clever laughs. I actually think I enjoyed the second season a little bit more than the first season, because I'm a dark and creepy character and I like the dark and creepy musical side of it more than I did the Rodgers and Hammerstein stuff. So I'm going to say Schmigadoon season 2, Schmicago, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I've got a retro review of Time Bandits, and I'm going to be talking about the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Blue Thermal. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews and talk about a retro review, Time Bandits. This is a movie from 1981, and it's directed by Terry Gilliam. So it's coming off of the Monty Python stuff that he had worked on, you know, obviously back in the 60s and 70s, and leading into the 80s, because he ended up doing Monty Python and the Holy Grail in 1983 afterwards. But let's go ahead and play the trailer. It's a little bit of a goofy trailer. Terry Gilliam directs his fantasy adventure about a child who's whisked away by a band of time-traveling thieves.
Time Bandits is an awfully good film. We have worked ever so hard on it. It's a tremendous adventure story. We like it, and we're pretty sure you will.
What's wrong with it? It's direct, punchy, honest.
Honest. What's that got to do with it?
That's the trailer. I don't know how else to cut the trailer, because the trailer itself is kind of a joke on trailers, especially back in the day. And that's very Terry Gilliam. Like I said, this is coming off of him doing the Monty Python stuff. Now, obviously, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and that was in the 70s. And the Monty Python Flying Circus TV series comes from the 60s. I think it went into the 70s. And, of course, they had Life of Brian. Terry Gilliam, if you don't know his history of Monty Python, he did the animation. That real distinct animation where he used paintings, classic paintings, and that when you look at something, you immediately can tell it's Monty Python, because he has these obscure, grotesque, almost as the look of Gian Wilson's design. I mean, it's grotesque and weird and everything. So Terry Gilliam, he was American, but he lived in the UK, and that's how he got hooked up with the other British folks for Monty Python. And he directed, I think he directed with Terry Jones a couple of the Monty Python movies. And then he started to do his own movies. And Time Bandits also has John Cleese and Michael Palin, who are former Pythons as well, playing in some bit roles in here. But this is, you know, Terry Gilliam, his stuff is weird, and it's always been weird. And that's what's so, it is wonderful about his stuff. I mean, this was his first, I would say, I mean, he did Jabberwocky too, but I mean, this was really his first big movie for himself. I mean, he went on to do stuff like The Fisher King and 12 Monkeys and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, but Time Bandits was his real first step forward into his own version of fantasy, and he has his own brand, and he ended up making two other movies after that. He did Brazil and The Adventures of Baron Munchausen that were sort of this fantasy trilogy looking at from different times in your life. And Brazil's a brilliant movie. I'll revisit that at some point as well. But Time Bandits mixes history and fantasy in this really amazing sort of way. Now, what's interesting about it is I was 10 when this movie came out. This was my introduction to Monty Python. It's not Monty Python, but it's Python-esque. And it stuck with me. I didn't quite get the movie, and there are parts of it I love, but there's other parts that bored me. But it's a movie that I've come back to and watched every 5 or 10 years throughout my life. I've seen it 5 or 6 times. And every time I see it, I get more out of it, because it's this brilliant deconstruction of a child's view of the world. Because it's the story of this kid. He's just this kid in the UK, and his parents are completely absentee. I mean, just like they're physically there, but they only care about status and the appliances they have. And the kid's in his bedroom, and he gets whisked away into this magical fantasy realm. And what's funny is all the Time Bandits themselves, it's a band of dwarves. And they've got a lot of famous dwarves at the time, those who acted, the British ones that were in stuff. Like Kenny Baker plays one of the characters. He's the guy who was in R2-D2 for the Star Wars movies. And the reason Gilliam chose dwarves is because they wanted somebody at the level of a kid. You know, because this child, he's the main character, and he's the focus of everything, but they just didn't want him kind of getting lost. And so he kind of fit in with this gang. And they go in all these different places, because basically they have this map that has these holes in time and space, and they go from place to place, and they end up like on the Titanic, and they end up in the Robin Hood times, and they end up, you know, during the time of Agamemnon and all that kind of Napoleon war. And it's just this crazy romp through European history, mostly European history. But it's weird and it's brilliant. And apparently they're going to be doing a TV series of this. Taika Waititi and Jemaine Clement are working on a TV series, which I think should be really interesting given their sensibility and their type of humor. So I'm very interested to see what ends up from the Time Bandits TV series. And I don't know when that's coming out. I think it's going to be on Apple TV. Hopefully that it's going to be coming out. They got 10 episodes, but you know, hopefully that'll be sometime this year. And I stumbled upon that. I just happened to be, it was on Max or HBO Max is what I ended up watching Time Bandits on. So you can catch that there. And it's inspired me to check out some more of Terry Gilliam's older films. I mean, it's out there in the most Gilliam sort of way. And this story balances whimsy with existential depression. That's the kind of the key, is it is it has this fantastically amazing element, but it's also got this existential emptiness to it. And that's very Gilliam. And that works. And I mean, they really lean into that in Brazil, but that's a discussion for another day. I'm going to say Time Bandits. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I don't have a trailer for this one I'm going to spotlight. It's called Blue Thermal. I think it came out a couple weeks ago. I got the DVD from Shout Factory, and I figured, oh, let's review this one. This anime follows an unsure college freshman who finds purpose in an avionics club. The reason I don't have a trailer is because it's in Japanese, and it's kind of, you can't exactly throw a trailer out there on national radio and have people talking in Japanese and have everybody just assume they're not saying anything bad. I mean, I don't think they are, but I don't speak Japanese, and I can't tell you whether something's inappropriate. I don't want to be caught on that. They don't have a dub trailer. They don't have a dub version. That's a major problem with the release. I wish that I know there's this big argument that goes on where there are people going, well, you're not really experiencing it if you don't hear it in the original Japanese. And it's like, yeah, but it's anime. And the dubbing on anime, I don't think is that bad. And I would much rather listen to the dialogue and witness what's going on in the frame than be paying attention to reading. But I'm not a typical anime fan. My kids are anime fans, and I know my son, one of them, insists on watching it in Japanese. So, but the thing with anime that's so fascinating with anime is it's not even a genre. It's just a style. And there's a lot of movies that are produced in Japan that are animated films that don't have any sort of fantastical element to them. They're not a fantasy. You know, they're not like the Hayao Miyazaki stuff like Howl's Moving Castle and Spirited Away where, you know, people are changing into pigs and buildings are standing up and walking away. They're very, well, I mean, down to earth is kind of a pun on this because Blue Thermal's about gliders that fly in the air. But this is really just a coming of age story. I mean, it's just this girl learning to be herself, learning to accept herself and accept her family because there's this sort of like this family dynamic that goes on at the university where she's studying. She leaves home. But her sister's at the school, or her half-sister is there, and there's some tension. But it ultimately is her finding her place, finding her love of aviation, and getting along with other people, maybe a little bit of a romance, but it's not hinged on a romance. It's not a romance, necessarily, because that's not the crux of the story. The crux of the story is this kid's development, and like I said, coming of age. And in today's America, you don't get movies like that in animated form. If you have an animated movie, it's usually a kid's film, or there's something fantastical about it, or something that prevents it from being easily filmed live action-wise. Like Super Mario Brothers looks a lot better as an animated film than that 1993 monstrosity that they did 30 years ago. But in Japan, they will tell these sweet little stories of people going to school. And they'll animate it this way. They have an entire industry based on it. It doesn't have to be fantastical elements. And I mean, it's not my cup of tea, but it's an enjoyable coming-of-age romance if you like that sort of thing. I'm not a big fan of that stuff, but I recognize it as being a quality film. And the animation is beautiful. I mean, it really is just landscapes and grasslands and the gliders flying over. But it's beautifully executed. So I may not connect with it, but I recognize that it's a good movie. And it's out by Shout Factory. You can get it on DVD and Blu-ray. And like I said, it doesn't have dubbing, but you know, if you're that much into anime, you're probably not going to be bothered by that. So I will say that Blue Thermal kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
And that's it. Next week, I'm going to be talking about another horror movie, Evil Dead Rise, and Beau is Afraid. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.